with a wonderful prayer. Glad that we have an opportunity to come on and be with you people. We've enjoyed ourselves very, very much this weekend. It was one of the best experiences that we've ever had. Much better than an assembly. Much, much, much better than an assembly. I'm Jim Lyman, and this is my lovely wife, Donna, and our two girls over there. The one sleeping is Deanie, and the other one is Nicole. It's our family. And I would like to share with you a little of our experience with the witnesses that we had. And our experience isn't quite like most of these other people. We've been hearing them all weekend. Very, very excellent speakers. A lot of experience with the organization, ministerial servants and Bethelites, and, you know, we were like puppies in that organization. We hardly even got in to know some of the witnesses, and we were gone. So maybe your outlook will be a little bit different. But we had such a wonderful time this weekend. I'll tell you what. Instead of doing this again next year, why don't we all come back and do this again next weekend? Yeah. How's that, guys? Okay, I'll let you tell them some of your experience with that.
All right. This Apex testimony meant so much to me. This is the pin that they gave me when I got baptized as a Jehovah's Witness. And it's got a perfect year. At the time, I thought it was a perfect year. December 25th, 1977. It was Christmas Day. Everybody else was putting up their trees and opening presents, and there I was, you know, in the blizzard, getting dunked by the witnesses. And I thought about throwing it away. I said, let me just toss this away. And then I said, no. I said, the Zapax gave me this, and it was their love that was the part I wanted to keep. So I've decided they have it engraved on the back with a date. So what I'm going to do is to have the engraver put little crosses over December 25th, 1977, and put my new baptism date, August 4th, 1984, right on top of it, I think. So we'll give you a little bit of our history. I was raised as a Lutheran. My family was fairly Christian in their attitudes, but we were really sorely lacking in Bible knowledge. And so I was really never got anything spiritually from that experience. And I went away to school, and there was just nothingness there. And it was interesting. When I was 16 years old, I was approached by the Mormons. I had gone to that expo down in New York City and had gone through the Mormon temple and signed my name in the book. So knock, knock, the Mormons came, and these two hunks came to the door. I was 16, and these gorgeous guys showed up. I was all smiles. I was ready to have a study. And their names were Todd and Stuart, and I just dearly loved them. They were just darling. And they came and played checkers, and we went swimming, and we went flying, and we did all kinds of fun things. It was just my family opened up to them, and there was nothing except just loving feelings of brothers and sisterly type of things. But one day, I was sick, and they came to visit me, and my mother said, Todd and Stuart are here. So I whisked down the stairs in my my bathrobe I had on top of it, and like Scarlett O'Hara, I said, hi, Todd, hi, Stuart. And here they were very, you know, uptight, rigid, and the elder was with them. And they introduced me to Elder Barry. And I remember laughing and saying, is that Elder Barry or Elder Barry? I was laughing, and at that time I was filled with joy. And he said, it's Elder Barry. You know, now I realize, you know, from the look on Todd and Stuart's faces, that we were all in trouble. Not that anything wrong was going on. So he said, oh, well, I've decided that we're going to all fast for you this coming Saturday. And my eyes got real big. And I said, fast for me? You know, I didn't want this response. And I said, no, aren't you serious in your studies? And I could see that it was a cult, although I didn't know that word at the time. And I said, no, please don't fast for me. And Stuart and Todd had encouraged me to leave my family and go to Utah, and they put me through school, I said no to that. Amazingly, I said no to that. And later in life, I would meet a Mormon, and she knew I was a witness, and she said, I can't believe you fell for that. And I was indignant, and I said, well, I can't believe you fell for that. You know, I can't believe that either one of us fell for either one. Anyway, I'll let you, let Jim talk about his background a little bit.
I was a member of a parochial school for 8 years, and then I went on to junior high or high school, whatever they call those things, with brothers, and I was raised Catholic pretty much of my life, and I was familiar with the way the Catholic organization ran, its structure, and the things that holds it together. And the thing that amazed me about Catholics was they were totally ignorant of the Bible, which probably is one of the reasons why so many ex-Catholics get involved with the Witnesses, because here is somebody who comes down the street and says, I have a Bible, would you like to read this with me and share a scripture or two? You go, Bible? What's a Bible? Sure, show me anything, you know. But the organizational structure of the church itself is the thing that the society is actually beginning to pattern themselves more and more after that, and refining what the Catholics do. And they were originally coming saying, oh, you were an ex-Catholic. Why, can you imagine how foolish that Pope is? He's out there, he says, when I speak dogma for the church, I am infallible. Can you imagine that ridiculous statement? Now, how much more ridiculous is the statement, I'm not a prophet, but the world's going to end in 1975, and in 1976 and 7 say, I never said that. And I'm not a prophet. I'm not responsible for what I say. But, of course, when you first come into that group, you get the red carpet treatment. You get the one-on-one. You have nothing to do with their central organization. You know nothing about their organization at all. They keep the organization totally away from you. It's one or two people come, and they sit down in the comfort of your home, and you have coffee, and you talk about scriptures, and they bring their little book. And they start you off on chapter one, and they ask you, what do you think? Do you think this is so? And they're very interested in your opinion. And then ultimately, when they get you to agree with them on a point, they go to the next point. And if you don't agree on that point, then they'll give you more study and more literature, and eventually they'll get your agreement on one point after another, after another. And you're going to say, they finally, you wake up, you say, what's going on? And they say, now that you are baptized, you are now responsible to go out and preach to these other poor lost sheep and put them in a wonderful position that you're in now. What's so wonderful about the position that I'm in now? I slept through most of these, they say, now it's time for you to go out and do the door-to-door work and everything. And I remember I was doing my studying, and I think we started studying in the fall. I met the Witnesses, and I introduced my wife to them, who at the time I was dating. We were an item. And after being with the Witnesses a couple, 3 weeks, I said to her, I said, gee, honey, I don't know if we should date so much anymore. And, you know, she's looking at me like, you know, what's wrong with this number? You know, who are these people? And I want to talk to them. Well, then she got involved with them. So. But it was like in the fall when I started studying, and I think she started studying. Well, actually, she started studying with Marilyn. Marilyn was her study, Lucky Marilyn. And I forget when that was. When was that, Mike?
Fall of 75.
The fall of 75. Well, the fall of the earth, or almost fall. The fall of 75, anyway. And I was getting pretty heavy into the studies. By the time I was about halfway through the book, they were encouraging me to go out with the Bible tract and literature and... So I said, yeah, okay, but why don't we wait till spring? They said, well, you know, you have to do this all the time. Day, you know, night time, doesn't make any difference, rain, snow, sleet. I said, I don't work for the post office, you know. Can't we just call them on the phone or something? Why don't you pick a nice day? It's zero. They're out there for the field study. They got me out there. And I'm saying, what am I, a penguin? I'm up there, I knock on people's door, and you get one of these because the door, you know, is zero. And the people go, what do you want? You say, I'm trying to share a scripture. They go, get lost. They close the door. I say, you know. So who's going to stand there and, you know, open the door and say, oh, yeah, what's the scripture you wanted? Well, the cold air is blowing into their house. They don't want to keep warm. They think you're crazy because you're out there. I'm sure of it. But I could not deter them, and because it was required, I went out and froze my fingers off. knocking on doors, trying to get people to open the door in the middle of the wintertime. But I was very successful. I had stacks of wakes and watchtowers, and I'd just knock on the door, and 3 seconds later, I'd drop one in, go to the next door. And so I had lots of placements. It cost me about $6 a shot to go out and do the door-to-door work, but I got those placements in, though. Anyway, go ahead and tell them a little bit about your beginning experience.
I just wanted to finish about Todd and Stewart. There was a sad consequence for them. After that visit, one was banned to Buffalo, and his car privileges were taken away. And the other one was sent to Scranton. He had to go on foot because one got a bicycle. And I guess the Lord must have been working even back then in my life. He would have, at the time I said, how hard-hearted, what kind of a group is that would do this? You know, I couldn't understand that. But it all comes together now for me as I see the same parallel with the witnesses. But we were going along, and as Jim said, we were doing the witnessing work. We never fit in. That's the bottom line. Jim and I never made it as a couple in the witnesses. We had these wine and cheese get-togethers we sent out. Because we were totally ignorant. I mean, as you will discover, we were warm-hearted and loving, but ignorant of these protocol things. So we sent out the invitations for the wine and cheese party. I can't believe they came, looking back on it. I mean, we had two different nights. We said, well, let's get to know all the brothers and sisters in the congregation. Let's open up our home. And so we did have two different evenings. No one ever invited us after that. I don't know. I mean, we just had a role. But we got to know them, and they got to know us, and I guess they decided they didn't want to know us any better. But we spent the next 4 or 5 years really working hard to grow in the organization. And that was the problem. We weren't growing in Christ. We didn't have Christ, as you all know. And we all these little rules, couldn't, with the mailboxes. And I know we decided to give a gift anonymously to this pioneer sister, and they almost zeroed in on us because we had put it in the mailbox. We didn't know the secret rule about how you don't put things in the mailbox. It had to be something.
They figured only an ignorant fool would put it in the mailbox, right? Right out of something.
So anyway, we were going along, and Jim got baptized about 4 years after I did, and that was a real highlight of our experience. We were going along. The picture in the brochure is us just before Jim's disfellowshipping. You can see, I don't know how we look in it, kind of nerdy, I don't know, but we were seemingly spiritual. We'd given up our families and some of our worldly friends, although we never really gave up everyone, fortunately. I'll let Jim tell you about his disfellowshipping experience.
Well, I was stalling getting baptized a little bit because I don't like to rush into things. But Donna had been baptized in 77. What year was I baptized in?
I must have been 81.
Well, all right. Anyway, they figured that was long enough. They said, hey, now it's time to make your commitment. You smoke. You have to give up smoking and become a witness or get lost. So I said, well, I don't know. You know, I'd just assume, you know, hang around a little bit longer and take my time about it. So they said, time's running out. You know, you have to make your stand. You believe in what we believe in. And all of the things that they gave you, that one step at a time that they got you to agree to, that had to build that pyramid of, so that the last thing that they put on top is balanced on everything else they gave you. So even if you're not quite sure you agree with anything, you just accept it because of all of the other things that you've already agreed to. And so they convinced me that I was being stubborn because I didn't want to quit smoking. So I said, all right, maybe they're right. I'll see what I can do. So I dedicated myself. I quit smoking, and which isn't easy to do, by the way. And I'll be the first one to admit that there were times when I backslid on that quitting smoking. I lost it a couple times, and I'd really feel guilty. You know, like, what a horrible, wretched, you know, like Paul. I really feel like Paul. I'm wretched. You know? And then I'd get back on the wagon again. And I had a couple, two of those. About maybe 6 months after I was baptized, the elders called, and one of them said, so-and-so, we got a report that so-and-so, hanging at some place, and saw you smoking. you know, is that true? I said, well, I don't even remember if I was there or not. But I said, it might be. It depends on, you know, when it was. Because I've done my backsliding on quitting smoking, and, you know, tough guy and all that. So they said, well, you know, we're going to mark this down in our book. See? So they marked it down in their book. And I didn't hear anything for a while. One of the brothers that was up here giving a talk the other day was talking about there was some oddball in his group that wouldn't answer the Watchtower questions the way they wanted them. And that was me.
He had his own translation. Still, after all these years.
But, you know, I was there to try and learn something about this. I was in a Watchtower study. I think it went, just for an example, it would say, it would start off, it would say, God is the eternal, you know, being of all powerful and all wise, with no beginning and no end. And then you get to the question and it'd say, who is God? You know, or name a quality about God, you know, and it'd have them all listed there, and then you were supposed to reread everything that was in the paragraph. Which is, that's normally the way they do that, or expound on everything that was in the paragraph. But I would, you know, try and find something that I didn't know about it before. I already just got done reading that God had no beginning and no end, and he was the all-powerful being. I mean, why should I answer the question with that? If I can think of something about him that isn't in there, and, it, you know, I come up with some pretty strange stuff. They must have thought I was smoking one of those funny weeds, but I'd raise my hand, and a brother would call on me, and he'd say, all right, Brother Lyman, I'd say, tell us something about Yahweh, and I'd say, he teaches in parables. Because Jesus teaches in parables. He says, everything I see my Father do, that's what I do. So if Jesus is doing it, his Father did it, you know. Guy says, sit down, brother. I thought, you know, that was something that I thought was, hey, that's something that's not in a book. It's original, you know. Maybe they'd like to know about that, or, you know, I guess not. But anyway, about 4 months after the first phone call I got from the eldest, I got another phone call. Some elder, we've had reports that you've been smoking and blah, 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 blah. So at this particular point in time, I said, well, when was this? Because I already had my history of, you know, and no, they said, this is very recent, like, you know, only a couple of weeks ago or something. So I told them, I said, well, I said, I wouldn't know anything about your reports, but, you know, at that particular time, you know, I'm in good shape. I didn't have any problems with it. So they said, well, we're going to have to come down, and you'll come down to the Kingdom Hall, and, you know, because some accuser is going to face you, and we got one witness. And I was accused, and I said, well, you know, hey, what am I going to say to the guy? I'm in an indefensible position. Do what you want, you know. I made my statement, and this guy made his statement, you know. So they determined that I should be disfellowshipped. I said, okay, well, you know, and of course I came back and told Donna. She said, well, you know, I don't understand it. So she said, well, we'll see what we can do about getting you back in good standing. I'll talk to the brothers and see what we have to do. So, well, I'll let her tell her the story about talking to the brothers and see what I have to do.
Well, I think it was the Lord's timing, because Jim had been growing and growing, and he was at the peak of what he was as a witness. He was out in service, and he was praying, and he was head of the family, and everything seemed to be working out really well. And then he came home and said, I'm disfellowshipped. He said, oh, stop kidding. I said, that's what you want. He said, no. And then it became clear that he was disfellowshipped. I couldn't believe it. I wasn't even asked to come with him. You know, I mean, here he was supposed to be smoking. You think they'd ask me, have you seen it? Have you smelled it? You know, have you tasted it? I mean, when you live with somebody, you know if they're smoking. Nobody ever approached me, and I'm convinced that he was not. Although at the time I pretended to be confused. I said, oh, well, he must be lying. You know, Brother Old has testified. Let me tell you about Brother Old. When Jim wanted to get baptized, he was our book study conductor. And I've never... Well, let's not say his name. All right, Brother Herbert. He can come see me. And I've never met anyone who was void of a sense of humor. You know, he just had no sense of humor. And as you can see, Jim and I enjoy a sense of humor. To us, that's part of the joy of life. And here we were put in his book study. He loved us from the beginning, let me tell you. And so I went to him. I thought it was good news. I said, Jim wants to be baptized. I expected, you know, great, you know, praise Jehovah. He went, what? What do you mean? We're busy right now. We're building the new Kingdom Hall. And I said, well, it's not till October. I said, this is, you know, the summer. He hasn't been regular in his attendance here at the book study. And I said, well, he works shift jobs, and he comes whenever he can. And he said, well, we don't have time for that right now, or we'll talk about it next week. And week and weeks went by, and it was like 2 or 3 weeks before his baptismal date, and I'd made big arrangements for a party, and I'd told my parents as a witness and all of our friends as a wonderful witness, James is finally getting baptized. And he says, we're all busy building the hall, and by the way, he hasn't been down there every weekend helping us. No. And I said, well, growth has taken place. I mean, let's be patient, you know. But Brother Old, he was just irritated with us, and he was determined that he was not going to be baptized. I couldn't believe it. So I went to one of our other elder friends, and I said, help me with this. I said, Jim wants to be baptized, finally. You know, help me. So he must have called this Brother Old and said, hey, you know. And so then he was obviously very annoyed because he came to me. Here I was 7 months pregnant at the time. He said, none of you have been out in field service at all. Now, I know that's between you and Jehovah, but this is terrible. And I said, well, we don't believe in turning in our field time reports. We've never done that. You know, what? You know, this is not God's arrangement. This is. And we said, well, we feel that's between us and the Lord. We don't like having to report that. And, you know, if he had been out on the weekends and we had been out during the week, he just assumed that we hadn't been out in field service. And I said, besides being 7 months pregnant, I said, it's hard going up and down all those steps, and we have a little 18-month-old daughter, and I tried to reason with him that it wasn't, you know, great to be pioneering. And he said, this is Jehovah, Jehovah, Jehovah. You know, I've never talked with anyone where I couldn't even understand what he was saying to me. It was like talking to a zombie. That was my first experience of robotism. And I just couldn't communicate with this man. It was very frustrating because I've always been able to talk with people pretty much, but with him, no laughter, no smiles. So anyway, Jim was disfellowshipped, and I was just crushed. Tears and tears, and it was this confusion. You know, who's lying? Is it the elders, righteous elders, or my husband, who's never lied to me? And I just continued being confused. Well, there is a responsibility being there. There's not confusion. You just don't want to, you know, have your whole world collapse. I put my faith in that organization. And I went on to make it alone. We never made it as a couple, but I made it in the organization alone. And I publicly apologized for that to my loving husband. What a horrible thing to do. I became Sister Zealous. I left him behind. I went on to the assemblies with our kids. I mean, I had their welfare at heart and my own, but I was going to make it as a witness in spite of him. And what a terrible thing. I just left him in the dirt behind.
Actually, I didn't feel as badly about my disfellowshipping as he did. I originally went in with the idea that, well, you know, hey, I'll continue attending the meetings, and after a period of time, you know, they'll come around and they'll say, well, you know, we see that you've been attending the meetings and keeping your big mouth shut, you know, and eventually that things would work out, which they did. Eventually they did work out. But I had a wonderful opportunity to get the best seat in the Kingdom Hall, because as I walked in, room was made around me. You know how crowded it gets, and I like to sit in the front. And how crowded it is, and everybody gets the best seats right up in the front. You know, the first ones in that are there 2 hours before the meeting time. You know, and I figure if they want the seats that badly, who am I to deprive them of them? But when I was disfellowshipped, I could walk in, and I'd be looking around, and wherever I looked, it would get empty, and I'd sit down, and then the next two on each side got empty, and there was room for the whole family, and we all had wonderful front row seats to all of the public talks and watchtowers and everything. I didn't push anybody or anything like that. They just moved out of the way when they saw me coming. I had the little bell, like the lepers, you know, unclean. worked. So we were there. We were getting good front row seats at all of the talks. And the amazing thing is, even having a better seat and being closer to the brother who was giving the talk, from being this fellowship and being an outsider, the things they were saying just weren't making sense anymore. It was just starting to get hard to put together maybe it was just the time that the organization was really going into high gear about mind control. I don't know. It just never seemed that when I was studying that the mind control was all of that strong. Everybody would always say, well, that's your choice, but there was like pressures, peer pressure, and other witnesses pressuring you to do things because it seemed the thing to do. But they were not saying to society, hanging, and you have to do this, and this is forbidden. But it was about that time where they had these rash of things from the Fox brothers and maybe Bill's literature or whatever, and they were losing people. I'm sure that people were starting to drop out of the witnesses to the point where the headquarters said, let's tighten up on this and not, you know, let's put more control on these people and keep, you know, try and close up those floodgates, those dams that are breaking open. And I remember distinctly, very shortly after I was disfellowshipped, I was sitting there, and some brother was going on about how you mark people. Has anybody been in the organization when they were marking people? Okay, you guys, that was fairly recent that came out with marking, where at least it was to me anyway. I never heard of it before. And I'm sitting there, and marking is a disfellowshipping that you do to somebody else. The organization doesn't disfellowship them. You do. Because you don't think they're good enough. And I'm sitting there, I'm going, oh, wait a minute, I'm disfellowshipped, and maybe I'm not good enough. But, who are they to say that I'm not good enough? I know I'm not good enough. But I don't think they're good enough either, and I don't think there's anybody left in the organization if we get down to who's good enough. But I didn't know how to approach Donna on that because she was being very zealous and trying to make up for the lack of whatever it was that I didn't have anymore in the organization. She was trying to carry both of us and started hearing all of these people come out with dogma, and it started to sound Catholic, you know, like old reruns of Catholic,
hellfire and brimstone. You can't eat meat on Friday. You...
Why not? Well, so
you're going to die if you eat meat on Friday.
Well, why? Does it become poisonous on Friday? I mean, you know, I could eat it on Thursday, and maybe, if I put it in the fridge, I could take it out Saturday and eat it, but it's fatal on Friday. And this was the same kind of stuff that was starting to, you know, come down out of, you know, and for me it was very easy to see because I was out. You know, I'm looking into the fishbowl now, not inside the fishbowl looking around where the water's distorting your vision. And to me, it's becoming clear that something's very wrong here. And now I don't think it's me anymore. I got enough of my own problems. I didn't have to have the extra problems that they would have given me.
So Marilyn told me a couple of the comments that some of she had heard around the Kingdom Hall. The nerve of him sitting down front. In front of, we have to look at him. When we look up at the speaker, we have to see his head. No, and then I had to sit next to him last week. You think they would have been encouraged? He came for 3 months after he was disfellowshipped, and I kept thinking, well, they're going to see, you know, if he's really ready to come back. He hadn't been smoking. I had never seen any signs of the smoking. So I went to the, we were cleaning the Kingdom Hall, and I went to the one elder, and I said, is Jim ready to come back now? You know, what has to be done? Nobody ever told us what procedures he had to follow. When he admits to his lying and Brother Old is shown to be right. It was Brother Old that testified against him, by the way. The same one in our book study. I couldn't believe that. that then he can come back, when he admits the lie. And I said, well, what if he wasn't lying? What channel is there open for him? He says, well, it's very obvious to me he lied. So-and-so testified, Brother Old and his wife and their little robot kids. And so that, I mean, these little kids were such robots. And so I made the mistake. Well, at the time I thought it was a mistake. I went to Jim. I said, I don't know. You have to admit you lied. And that was it. He got his cigarettes out right at that moment and lit one up. He went out to the drugstore and he came back and he was smoking. I mean, so we went through this terrible time. And I have to say that people were very much more warm and friendly towards me at the hall. But, of course, they didn't have to invite me to their home because I had a disfellowship to me. You know, it was easy to be friendly at the hall. There was nothing that could be done. And it was a very sad time. I had two toddlers at the time, almost a newborn and our little two-year-old. And fortunately, though, I was busy with the pooping and the burping and all of the things that come with two little kids. And I used to rotate them. I'd bring one or the other, and because bringing two was really hard, until the brothers came to me and they said, sister, you're spiritual head of your family now. You must bring them both. So there I was in these meetings with little kids for 2 hours. It was, and there's no exit or no place to go. And you'd hear some of the parents feeding these little kids in the back. You know, and I would go in one of the extra rooms that was provided when their time was up. I would just go and sit with them and hold them. And Duane is absolutely right. I don't know if he's here now, but when I think about my friends that are still in there with some of their children that I love dearly, you know, I am determined that I am going to do everything I can to be a tool to get those people out and those kids out. I look at those little darlings over there. Thank goodness they're never going to be wolves. You know, I'm a forgiven wolf, but they're never. So anyway, to get on with things, we were kind of in a sad shape. So I decided, let's just isolate ourselves. So we sold our home and we moved up here around Lee Heighton. I said, let's just go back to nature. You know, the Isaiah where it says, I'm going to go up to the mountain of Jehovah. So I'm going to take that literally. I'm just going to go up to the mountain of Jehovah. And that's what we did. We packed the car and we took all of our things and we just moved right up to Lee Heighton, right up to Bear Creek Lake, which is in the middle of nowhere. I mean,
on the top of the mountain.
On the top of the mountain, yes. And I continued going to the Lee Heighton Kingdom Hall. And it was a pleasant experience there because the brothers and sisters there were much further removed from the organization. There weren't cliques. Most of the people there had disfellowshipped mates or children. Or almost everyone had disfellowshipping in their family. So, I made it there. I really fit in. And I was accepted warmly with love. I was invited to people's homes. It was a complete contrast to the cold-heartedness of the Allentown congregation. And I look back on it now and I think how the Lord used me, you know, to be in both these congregations, that I came out and they both would know it. And when the Zapaks told me all that they had found out about these false prophecies, I had never known about any of those things. And I had been going to the Kingdom Hall there for 2 years without Jim, and to the different assemblies and all. I was a sister that was out in field service every week, and I was really maintaining things very well, but I was so unhappy. I mean, my marriage was not there. We were apart. My family was not there. I had given up all friends, really. I was just really alone on this mountain with the leaves coming down. You know, I'd see the leaves coming down, and I'd say, well, I just have to wait for Armageddon to come. There's nothing more for me here. We were involved in lots of activities. I mean, that was a form of some kind of escape, but not really anything meaningful. And I'll let you continue along here.
Okay, yes, she decided that we should get away from Allentown and move up to the mountains, which we did, right to the top of the mountain at the Bear Creek, which is about 7 miles east of Jim Thorpe, which I don't know if any of you people are familiar with this area. Jim Thorpe isn't very big, but it's the center of culture in the area. So we were out in the middle of nowhere. And she started going to the Lee Heighton congregation, and she came back and said, oh, what wonderful people I met. I said, sure, now meet wonderful people. But, you know, and I'm not allowed to go in. But as a family, we drew pretty close because there was nobody else to talk to. She had to talk to me. She might go out and witness on occasion and go to a meeting or something here and there or whatever, but there was, you know, when she came back, there was nothing there but me. So we got rather close as a family, even though under the ideal circumstances, she wouldn't be speaking to me because I was disfellowshipped. It was kind of a weird time for me because I was reading various Bible translations different from hers, and I'd come in and I'd say, I don't agree with this in Revelations. And I mean, Revelations was one of the weird ones. That was something they were doing just as I was leaving, because as the organization got into Revelations, which is so symbolic that, you know, I mean, after the first two or three words, I'm blown away. They would be in there telling you about, see, the beast has 10 horns, and this is what the 10 horns and the 7 heads and 3 eyes. And so you got to be kidding me. I can't, you know, and the statue with the clay feet and the iron legs. And I said, oh, wow, so cut me a break, will you, pal? But and they had it all, everything. And they had the 7 horns and the 7 bowls for the 7 plagues and the 7 angels with the 7 trumpets. And they, everything was this was this, that was that. And the little fiery hail, that was the watchtowers coming down from there. Yeah, and the horses. And, so I said, well, wait a minute now, you know, let me just go out and buy a normal Bible, just an everyday, you know, Bible for idiots. And maybe I can understand what it says. And it's symbolic the way you're not... Because here you are. Here you got John up in heaven. And something goes by. He goes, what was that? He says, write that down in a book. He says, what was it? They said, well, what did you see? He says, I don't know. It was fiery. It flew across the sky. He says, I don't know what it is. And with his limited language, how could he even describe, you know... what's going on in heaven? He's got no words for that. So what he's actually doing is writing down, to the best of his knowledge, things that are confusing him to write them down. How can you read them and understand what they are? It's got to confuse you, too, to some degree. I think the object for Revelation is to encourage the people to the fact that the day is going to come. And that these things are going to take place. And that there will be signs on the earth. But how you're going to figure out what all of that stuff is up there, you forget it. I mean, John was looking at it, and he didn't know what it was. So, you know, I started to wonder about the Watchtower organization, especially with their spiritual remnant, which adds in to be the same thing as the Catholic Pope when you plug in the little secret formula. See, I am Jehovah's mouthpiece, therefore I am speaking for him. He is never wrong. Now, I'm not saying I'm never wrong. But if I'm speaking for him and he is never wrong, what I am saying has to be true. So didn't the Pope say that a couple thousand years ago? You know, when I speak for Christ, I have to be right because of me being his representative. So the organization now usurps the position that Jesus is supposed to have as your mediator. See, they saying to you, you know, he's not your mediator. We're your mediator to him.
I had this one especially dear friend up in Lehigh, and he was this old crusty guy. He reminded me of Donald Duck. He had white hair and kind of a quacky voice. But he was in there. I mean, he was just so loving, and his wife wasn't coming to meetings anymore. And he was old. I won't say how old, but I mean, he was not a romantic person that you would, you know. He was maybe this high, and you know, I'm pretty tall. I mean, it would never come into your mind that romance would be taking place between me and this particular man.
Like Popeye, not Donald Duck.
Oh, Popeye. Well, whatever. Anyway, he was kind-hearted, and he would take the girls and myself way up from Bear Creek Lake down to Lehigh Congregation, because it was dark. I mean, there were bears and deer, and I was kind of afraid going to the Kingdom Hall by myself with 2 little kids. So he would come in his truck, and we'd all bump down together, and we'd laugh and have a good time. And at the hall, we'd laugh and have a good time. And then we decided we were going to move down the mountain the next year when our lease was up. And the Lord started working in our lives. Nicole started school, and her best friend was this born-again Christian's family. She loved her instantly, and they loved each other. And all the homes that we wanted to rent got canceled out at the last minute. And so the Lord directed us to this home right across from Babylon the Great. Two ministers right across the street, you know, Parsons Purchase. And I said to Jim, I said, right across the road. And so the Lord was working on us, only we didn't know it at the time. And here I was with this one friend of mine at the Kingdom Hall, and zap, all of a sudden he was aloof. I thought, gee, maybe I've offended his wife. I was calling her and pursuing getting her back to meetings or going out to lunch or whatever. Got no response from him. If he'd see me coming in the hall, he'd turn around and go the other way. And I thought, boy, I'll give it a little more time, and then I'll approach him as to what the problem is. Well, after Marilyn and Tom shared all of their, what turned out to be very good news, I was really thrilled when I found out that the witnesses weren't the truth. I mean, here it was so downhearted. That one psalm, it says, why so downcast, O my soul? Why so disturbed within me? You know, well, now I know it's because I didn't have the Lord. But when I found out for sure that that was not the truth, I was really excited. And naive me, I said, wow, boy, these elders, they're going to be, everybody in my congregation, they're going to be thrilled when I tell them all this stuff. Can you imagine being that naive? I figured they didn't know. How could they know and still stay there? Well, I learned from their experience because they really snuffed them out in a flash. So I took a different approach. I wrote to all of these dear friends of mine, all the ones I was close to in the congregation. I wrote long letters and said, we've been deceived, you know, blah, blah, and all the things I read in your literature and Duane Mignogna's book. I quoted some of those things, and I listed them all, and I told them how much I loved them. And I really wanted them to know before they snuffed me out, because I knew they were going to snuff me out. So sure enough, you know, the elders came right away. These letters, what do I put? Doing with these letters? You know, they've gone out. Why didn't you come to us first? And I said, well, I said, I've seen all of this material. I said, the gig's up. I said, I know. I said, I know. And I said, maybe you would like to know too. Now let me show you this, you know. Is that 30 question book? Is that what you apostate literature? Those are all lies. Look at your friends, the Zapaks. They're liars. Liars. This is what a dear friend of mine has said. Those liars in Allentown. I said, hey, I said, I've known the Zapaks for years and years and years, and there is nothing in them that's liars. They're dear, kind, and they're still dear, kind, loving people. I said, it's the elders that didn't handle things lovingly. They were cold and cruel, and, well, you know, it was two different sessions of them laughing and ridiculing me. One elder said to me, even you have to admit this point. And I turned to him and I said, do you think I'm demonized? Do you think I have Satan in my spirit? And they said, yes, we think you do. And I said, well, I said, I guess this is the parting of the way. But with me, they dragged it out for months and months. I mean, it just went on. Every time the phone would ring, I'd say, is it them calling? And there's this one elder that must have been assigned to me. He would write in these long letters, and at the end of each letter, he'd sign it, Earl E. Ziegenfuss, Jr. III. Now, somebody I'd known for 2 years. I'd been in his book study, and so when I had cause to talk to him at the very end, he called me to see whether I'd changed my mind. I said, no. He said, I have a question for you. I said, you've known me for 2 years, right? He said, yes. I said, why did you sign your letters to me, Earl E. Ziegenfuss, the third? You know, I said, isn't that kind of formal? I didn't even put elder, you know, in this whole thing. And he said, did I do that? And I said, yes. He said, I didn't even know I did that. And I said, well, maybe that's part of the problem. You don't even know half of what you're doing. I said, you know, you're... I said, you have blood guilt for these people in your Kingdom Hall. I said, you're the one that comes here and makes these bottom line decisions for that organization down there. I said, I don't think of any of you as lacking sincerity or love. I love you all. I said, but you have blood guilt here. And it was like talking to brick walls or circular logic. I got very discouraged. I was so disappointed and disheartened that they didn't want to know. I was just so naive. I said, oh, they're going to just be so thrilled as I was to find out this isn't the truth. So I wrote to headquarters. I said, take my name off any list you have. I do not want my name listed on any record that I was ever a Jehovah's Witness. I wrote a letter to Nicole's teacher, who I had given all that stuff, that little blue book that explains sitting and standing during the Pledge of Allegiance, and if you're down, you're up, and if you're up, you're down, and if you're standing, it's okay. I mean, we had, maybe you all missed that particular brochure. It was ridiculous, and how this was wrong, and that was true. No cheerleading, and no singing, and no nothing. So I wrote her a long letter. I said, sit down. I said, I want you to know I'm a sincere person. I said, I don't want you to think I'm just a flake. I said, I sincerely became a Jehovah's Witness. I wanted to dedicate myself to God, and I still have that desire. I said, but we're no longer Jehovah's Witnesses. And so I said to Nicole later, I said, what was your teacher's reaction when she read this letter? And she said, I watched your face, Mommy, and when she got to the little bit down, she went, ah! She said, this big smile came all over her face, and she said, praise the Lord.
Well, I guess along about the time that Donna started writing her congregation about all of this apostate literature and things that she'd been reading, which I think they blamed me for because I was the evil one in the family, and they finally came down to see her, and I happened to be in the house. And they were telling her about how Satan was doing this to her and everything. And I was just beginning to wonder, hey, maybe Satan isn't such an old boy, bad old boy after all. You know, he was bringing her out of there. But then I said, no, I know that Satan's really not a good guy to play around with, and it has to be somebody else, which there's only one who can really bring somebody out of darkness. And we know who that is. That's the Lord. Amen.
Oh, just a couple more things I wanted to say. Our little Nicole, she was so funny when the elders came. She was in watching television, and they said, you know, I haven't been to a movie in 14 years. The ones that she was watching Star Wars on a tape. Star Wars, they were criticizing her for that. And they were saying to me, and she came up to him, and she looked at him. She came up real quietly, and she stood right in front of his face, and she said, my daddy's not bad. And then she turned on her heels and she strolled back out of the room. The same little creative being was able to get enough joy out of those songbooks to twirl out into the aisle one time. You know, she was just filled with joy and she twirled out into the aisle and she got what I refer to as the raised eyebrow. You know, and later some of the elders... wise would come to me and say, do you need help with your children during the service? You know, and I said, I thought that was great how she had that much joy. And at the church we go to now, she came out singing one day, Majesty, worship His Majesty. And she's coming out and everybody's smiling and glowing. They thought it was great. So what a contrast. We're just such a happy, joyous family. The love that's grown amongst us is just so intense. We love the Lord so much, and we want to get involved in ministries. I feel the Lord's calling me to work with Jews for Jesus. I feel that when we were witnesses, we were all Jews, spiritual Jews. I mean, we didn't have Christ, and we had all those Mosaic laws reincarnated. Really, the Lord is sending Jews to me in droves. And I just pray I have the strength to be quick-witted enough. Jewish people are so quick-witted and creative. I hope I have the patience, and it's a real strong desire for me that the Lord's given me. One conclusion about David, my friend David. They used him as a tool to try to keep me in the organization. You know, he was aloof, and I never understood it until he came. When he got his letter, he came, and he said, the reason I haven't been approaching you as the elders came to me, and he had a dossier of some past affair that he had when he was younger, and they were afraid that he was getting involved with a young sister again. So for he was afraid of romance occurring. This guy was, he even had an artificial leg. He couldn't, it was so sad. It just about broke. That was the last straw for me. That was the last straw. I said, David, what do you do with the love? Where does the love go? I said, what are you going to do with your love for me and the girls? Are you going to put it in some kind of envelope and lick it and throw it in the garbage? Where does that go? It's such a negative thing. When you get shunned, I was shunned for the first time, and I was interested to see how I would react. And I had just been to church, and I had this big, warm, glowy smile that I presented her with because I still love her. And the hate I got there, I was so surprised at the hate. I was with a friend who didn't know anything about the situation. She said, you know, I didn't know that person, but boy, if looks could kill, you'd be dead. She said, did you know that person? And I explained to tell her, and I said, let's say a prayer for her. I said, just right now, say a prayer for that person. So we did, and I pray for them all. I love them all.
I just wanted to check and see how much time we had left. I wanted to make sure we didn't, you know, keep running off at the mouth and hold everybody up, because I know what a wonderful afternoon it is and how everybody's been here all day, all week, listening to all these testimonies and says, you know, okay, when is this loudmouth going to, you know, finish up since he gave his witness? And the only thing I'd like to say, I think that we should be folding up about now, unless you have something you really want to say. Don't you dare. No.
Covered it all.
The only thing that I would like to say, that if it is his will that we should all be together, us and more, with him, and until he comes, that we should keep congregating together in ever larger numbers and with ever more love. Amen.
Thank you.